my time travelling friends, and welcome back to the Tudor Travel Show. And this, the third episode in my very special series, following in the footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots. Now, I hope you enjoyed the first two episodes where we visited the Palace of Linlithgow, and then last week we were at Stirling Castle, of course. Well, today, where are we? Well, I make my first of two visits to Edinburgh. And as you will hear in this particular episode is split into two parts. In the first part, I'll be meeting with Jerry O'Zenietz, who takes us on progress from Edinburgh Castle down the Royal Mile in the footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots, as she made her royal entry, her formal royal entry, into the city of Edinburgh shortly after her return to Scotland from France in 1561. And then in the second part of the show, I'll be meeting up again with Liz Manson, president of the Mary Stuart Society. And we are in conversation at Holyrood Palace, which of course is right at the other end of the Royal Mile. Okay, so I think what we're going to do is we're just going to dive straight on into things today, and let me go over and introduce you to Jerry, who can tell you all about himself and then take us on a fabulous adventure in time down Scotland's, Edinburgh's I should say, Royal Mile. But do remember, of course, folks, that we recorded this episode amidst the bustling heart of a city, so you will hear all the sounds of life going on around us. Hello, everyone, and welcome to day three of my tour in the footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots, where we follow on the trail of the Scots Queen. And today I am in the capital city of Scotland. That is, of course, Edinburgh. And here I am just on the castle esplanade outside Edinburgh Castle, and I'm with Jerry. Jerry, hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
So for those of folk who are listening in today, they're going to notice that you don't have a Scottish accent.
No, I don't.
You're not from these shores.
No, I'm originally from Chicago, but I ended up in Edinburgh for work in the year 2001. And I absolutely fell in love with the city. And, of course, investigating the history of the city and having had a long-standing interest in the Reformation, you cross the two, of the city of Edinburgh, the Reformation, and, of course, you come across Mary, Queen of Scots.
Of course. So this is a paradise for you, Jerry.
This is wonderful.
Now, I'm meeting you here because you're a bit of an expert, of course, on Edinburgh. And we're going to go on a journey along the Royal Mile today. But today is a very special day, isn't it?
Well, today, yes, is actually the day in 1561 where Mary landed at Leith, returning from France to retake her role as Queen of Scotland, of course, having had the tragic circumstances of her husband having died as King of France. And of course, he was also King of Scotland.
Yeah, and I understand when she arrived, it was quite a misty day, not unlike today, in
fact. Indeed, apparently even worse. It was apparently very, very rainy and very poor. And of course, she was early, so the people were not there ready to receive her. So she had to take refuge in a local home until they could organize horses for her and to be able to come actually up to Holyrood Palace.
Well, we kind of had that experience because when we arrived in Scotland on Monday, it was absolutely peeing it down here with the mist and so on and so forth. So yes. I'm feeling very empathetic with her at the moment.
Yes, although the festival's not here this year, welcome to the festival weather.
Ah, right. Okay, I get it. Anyway, so yes. Good. So, as I say, we are now going to be following in her footsteps as she entered, made her royal entry.
Her formal entry into the city, correct, as ruler of Scotland, yes, to reclaim her place.
But maybe before we start, because we're going to be walking in a minute, we're going to head on off our way, but it's always good to have a bit of context and background, isn't it?
Yes.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, what brought Mary to this and what was going on in Scotland at the time?
Right. Well, of course, the political situation was quite extraordinary. The political environment of the time was very fraught. The entry that Mary took, of course, was as per the normal entries that royals did. It was designed to display the magnificence of the sovereign and the loyalty of the citizenry. Mm. The notion behind such an occasion was that the monarch, the court, the civic community all shared an ideology. The past, present, and future relations between sovereign and subjects were to be dramatized, in which both acknowledged each other's role as part of the political community. However, in this case, it was more of an ambush than an entry.
Tell me more.
It replaced the expected dialogue with admonitions and threats. And in fact, Douglas Gray, I quote, he says, "It would be hard to find a more extreme or intense example of a tendentious message being given to a monarch."
Because she arrived back in difficult religious circumstances.
Well, the year before, in 1560, the Scots Parliament adopted Protestantism as the official religion of the country.
Oh, so it was just a year before, so it wasn't long.
No, it wasn't. Oh, okay. And of course, Mary and Francois, as King and Queen of Scotland, had never, of course, given royal assent to such a decree. But again, the thing was such that even the city of Edinburgh cut out the image of St. Giles from its own town flag.
Oh gosh, and St. Giles was a Catholic?
The patron saint of the city.
Oh, I see. Wow, so they were getting rid of everything.
Absolutely. And in fact, the year, in December of the previous year, there was a riot and they destroyed the chapel at Restalrig a little bit further out of Edinburgh. Mm. I mean, it's actually part of Edinburgh today,
but
it was at that time outside the city walls.
So, okay, so it was a turbulent time. Mary was just, what, 18 years old when she arrived back, 18, 19?
Oh, let me think, 1542, so she was 18, 19.
So a young woman who'd made quite a courageous, and I often think, maybe slightly confusing decision to return to Scotland, because she could have led a very cosseted life in France, but she came to a land that she hadn't known since she was 5 years old, and she was in the midst of all of this turbulence going on.
Yes, but interestingly enough, despite the fact that she had left when she was like 5 years old, she had actually still retained her ability to speak Scots.
Yes.
Because, of course, she had the Marys with her, and she practiced Scots with them all her time in France. So although French was probably her preferred language, she was certainly fluent in Scots.
Okay, okay.
So she did have a connection with the people in that sense.
Yeah. So look, we're here on the Esplanade. This is just outside the main entrance to the castle, Edinburgh Castle, which is behind us. And for those who are tuning into the podcast, we're going to be back to actually explore Edinburgh a little later on this week. So you'll be able to join me as I go on a tour of the castle itself. But that's not for today. Today we are going to be heading down the Royal Mile, but maybe you could just explain to us, as we perhaps start to walk, a little bit about the city. So you mentioned the city was a walled city, and of course it was much smaller than it was today.
Yes, the city at the time really just consisted of what we now know as the Royal Mile, and of course the closes and the wynds off of it. The city, as we did say, yes, it was walled. The Flodden Wall had obviously not been long before constructed. North of the castle itself, of course, was what was called the Nor Loch, sort of at that stage probably a bit of a cesspit. But it was there as a defensive measure. It was an artificial lock, and obviously it prevented meant that they didn't need to build a wall on that side of the city itself. So yes, the city much smaller, much different, and there were fields obviously extending to the north, which is of course where, when Mary had to take the formal route, which was an established route, had been over the centuries, the various royals used it as the entry into the city. She came, of course, from Holyrood Palace, and she came up what is along what was called the Lang Gate. Although now that's roughly where George Street is.
Right.
And
okay.
So she came up on horseback, obviously with her entourage, around St. Cuthbert's Church and around to the West Port.
And St. Cuthbert's Church still survives It's yes. still here.
Yes, it is.
Okay,
yes.
So if people wanted to use that as a landmark, then Absolutely. That could be part of the
Absolutely.
Route.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, great.
And then to the Westport, which is effectively where the beginning of the grass market is now.
Okay, right.
So we should
And proceed. was that the beginning of the kind of the formal piece?
Yes, yes. That was the entry was then from the Westport up the West Bow, as it's called. The West Bow doesn't really exist anymore. Part of it still does. but it was really a very steep incline. So Mary would have come in to the city that way. She would have then come into the castle, because before the actual then procession down to the back to the palace, they had lunch.
Oh, okay, so they would have been up there at the castle.
They would have gone into the castle, fine. And they would have had a fine meal.
So we're now really picking up the story as she leaves the castle and does this formal procession.
Correct.
Back down to Holyrood, I guess.
That's right, that's exactly it. And of course, you have to remember, is at that time, Edinburgh was two royal boroughs.
Okay.
There was Edinburgh itself, but there was also the Canongate. So the actual procession, although she eventually gets to Holyrood, sort of actually ends at what was then the Netherbow Port, which is, of course, marked by a pub called World's End.
Okay. And port, I guess, must have been from gate?
Gate, port is an entry, yes.
So, Jerry, as we head down the hill, where do we go next? Do we carry on down
actually,
the hill or not?
We take first the fact that we have to understand that the first thing that Mary saw as part of the formal procession was as she exited the castle, the first scene she encountered was some of 50 young men in blackface, believe it or not.
Blackface?
Blackface.
Okay.
Yes, suggesting Moors, you see.
Uh-huh.
They were dressed in yellow taffeta with bare arms and bare shins, black hats and masks, with rings decorated with multitude of precious stones in their mouths, and chains of gold around their necks.
Wow.
Their legs, arms, and faces were all painted black. These men represented the outlandish powers of chaos, which were to be subjugated by the authority of a Christian ruler, and were customarily depicted as wild men in one form or another. So this was a normal sort of pageant at the time. So this is the first thing that Mary encountered. And along with this, 16 men greeted Mary. They're probably the town council itself. And again, they were dressed very impressively in velvet robes and caps. And there was a rich canopy of purple velvet lined with red taffeta and fringed with gold and silk, under which she was to ride downhill. Obviously, in case the weather wasn't so good, she was protected.
Indeed. So this all happened just outside the castle.
Outside the castle,
really where
yes.
we are now.
Yeah, pretty much, yes. Certainly in this area.
Mm.
But then next came a cart with certain bairns and containing a coffer wherein was a cupboard. That is, a wagon in which there were children and a chest containing silver plate. And this was a gift for her from the city.
Uh-huh.
And this cart then followed her all the way to Holyrood.
I see. Very nice. Having your gold and silver following you in a cart. Excellent. Just to underline the fact that you've got all this money and wealth and power.
Yeah.
Now, things look a bit different, obviously, today. You know, I was just talking to you before, wasn't I, about, you know, what is left of the 16th century city. Are there any 16th century buildings? There are not that many, I understand.
No, not an awful lot is left. One way or another, there's been various urban renewal, etc.
So the kind of the imprint of the road remains, but the buildings that we are largely passing by have been lost and changed over time.
Yes, the pathway of the road is pretty much the same as it was at that time, although probably its width varied a bit differently at that time than it is now.
What, wider or shorter?
Just different places were different.
I
so
see.
It was probably narrower at some places than it is now, and all other places it was probably wider. But probably a lot of that was just the fact the way they built. building regulations I don't think existed.
No, I don't suppose there was many of those.
Health and safety, etc., non-existent pretty much.
Oh, to live in those times, that's all I can say.
Well, I'm not so sure that we want to sacrifice safety for pageantry. But anyway, so the first thing, the first stop then the procession made was basically where we've come to now.
Okay.
Obviously, this was completely different at the time. As I mentioned, the way Mary came up to the castle initially was via the Bow, and you'll see over there by roundabout there's what's called Upper Bow.
Yes.
So that's roughly where she would have come up originally to go,
into
the castle.
To the castle, right.
Then she would have come back down to here. Now here was a thing called the Buttertron, or a way house. Okay. It was at the top of the straight bow. Now, of course, we see the roundabout, the junction of Castle Hill, Johnson Terrace, and West Bow, and the Lawn Market. The Buttertron was destroyed in 1822 to widen the approach to the castle for the visit of King George IV. Now, I knew he was fat, but I don't think they needed that much room. Here there was an port made of timber in maced honorable fashion, color it with fine colors, hung in with sundry arms, under which some children sang in the maced heavenly wise. That is, what there was a colorful timber arch festooned with arms, probably the arms of the town and probably of Mary herself.
Mm-hmm.
Then a cloud, or a globe perhaps, depending on the source, opened, and a boy of about 6 years of age descended, as it had been an angel, who handed her a Bible and a Psalter, which were both covered in fine purple velvet, as well as the keys to the town. As he recited the following anonymous poem, although we think it might have been written by one William Lowder: "Welcome our sovereign, welcome our natural queen. Welcome to us your subjects great and small. Welcome, I say, even from the very spleen, to Edinburgh, your city principal, whereas your people, with hearth both ane and all, doth here offer to your excellence two proper volumes in memorial, as gift most genand for a godly prince."
They loved their verses, didn't they?
Absolutely.
And it was always so obsequious at the top.
Of course, of course. However, there is something very significant about this poem. The most significant line is, "truly translated with faithful diligence." This was decidedly Protestant.
Okay, right.
Mary would have expected both those books, the Bible and the Psalter, to be in Latin, not in Scots or English.
Although, did she show any reaction to any of this? I mean, did she?
Oh, very much so.
Okay.
In fact, although one of the sources claims that both of the books were in Scots, it is far more likely that the Bible itself was in English. But the Psalter itself, which was obviously meant to be sung, would have probably been in Scots. As a result, her reaction, she began to frown.
Oh, really?
And gave it to Arthur Erskine.
Oh, right. So she did show a reaction.
Oh,
so
yes.
There you go.
She understood the symbolism.
Do you think she was expecting that? Or do you...
No. That's why earlier I called this an ambush as opposed to a celebration.
Yeah.
They were really trying to impose on her what they thought the religion should be and how it should be practiced. It's very difficult, I think, for us to put ourselves in the mindset of the people of that time and how important religion was, not only how important it was, but how divided they were and their views of it.
Yes.
It's really quite extraordinary.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. I think it is very hard to put ourselves in their footsteps. Yeah. We just don't understand, I think, often the power of the their conscience, their whole conscience, their whole, everything was bound up in that. So now we're back on the main street, on the Royal Mile.
And so again, after they've had the little presentation of the books, they would have proceeded down towards St. Giles.
So is this St. Giles?
Yes.
Aha. Oh, that's pretty, isn't it? Look at the beautiful carving around the doorway.
Yeah, that is very, I mean, that's older than Riddle's Court, of course.
You of course.
I mean, not all of it, but, you know, various parts.
What an unusual...
it's an imperial crown.
Yes, that's what exactly what it looks like.
That's what it is, yes.
That's what it looks like. Yeah. So, you brought me, Jerry, down to St. Giles Church. So tell me about...
Although actually what we're having to imagine is what was called the toll booth, which acted as a parliament, as a prison, and various other things. Because here there were two scaffolds set up, one above the other. On the top was a lady representing fortune, and under her were three more women, signifying love, justice, and policy. Policy meaning government. Mm. This symbolism would have been obvious to Mary, as well as all those observing the pageant, since understanding imagery was something that was ingrained in a society which had limited access to the written word.
Mm.
That's the thing, again, one of the things trying to get yourself into the mindset of a medieval person is to understand that written things were not their main form of communication. It was imagery, hence why there was all the stained glass, why there was all the statues and paintings and so forth, which of course the Protestants wanted to throw all away. But there you go.
No, but you're right. I mean, they were very good at reading symbolism into things, placing symbolism into paintings and so on. So would this place was a regular stop on the royal procession?
Correct, yeah, the toll booth.
And can you tell us anything about the church? Because it is a beautiful church. So how long has this been here?
For as long as I think anybody knows. I mean, there has been a church, not probably in this form, but from a very, very long time ago. I mean, it's older than Riddle's Court, for example, although not what we see now. What parts of it are that old, etc., is very hard to say, because, of course, it's been developed over many, many centuries.
Yeah. But it's a beautiful entranceway with this carved doorway, really intricate carving around the doorway. And
yes, very, very Gothic, isn't it?
Yeah. Beautiful. So, okay, so now we're moving on again. We're passing St. Giles Cathedral.
Yeah, and we're going to be going to what was called the Mercat Cross, the, if you like, Market Cross.
Aha, Market Cross.
Now, the current Market Cross, which we'll be coming to at the other side of St. Giles, is a Victorian creation, the original obviously having met its demise long ago.
And I guess on each side of the road there would have been houses which were several,
Actually, there were what were called the Luckenbooths.
Luckenbooths.
Yes. Basically, they were shops for traders to do various things. The goldsmiths and other trades plied their wares.
So this
was actually quite narrow at this point, at that time, because the Luckenbooths came out from St. Giles. You see,
so narrow street overhanging the road.
They were actually not overhanging; they were sort of like impinging on the road. it was a narrow passageway.
I see. So there's some markings in the road. They're kind of brass plaques.
Yes.
And actually, they're going right through the middle of the road. So they really, so it really was quite narrow at that stage.
And there are various other markings in the road, like where the toll booth was. Is marked, the corners are marked, etc.
Oh, I see.
Over there. So
So this is where the modern day road maybe deviates a little bit from where...
Well, the road itself, but remember the locking booths were built on top of it. Again, because there were no sort of like planning regulations, people just built whatever they could wherever and whenever without sort of any control. As long as you had the money to do it, you just got away with it.
You just got on with it.
Yeah.
Right.
But here we are at the Merket Cross.
Okay.
So this is now the next stop on the formal pageant.
In front of us, it's what, an octagonal monument
with some octagonal
beautiful heraldic symbols, and then the post with a unicorn and the Scottish flag sitting atop of that.
Yeah, like I say, this is actually a Victorian creation. The original Merket Cross long ago disappeared, but there has been a Merket Cross roughly in this location, probably not quite here. I'm sure it's been.
Are there any contemporary drawings of it? Do we know what the original looked like?
I'm not aware. That doesn't mean they don't exist.
Yes.
Of any contemporary illustrations of the Merket Cross at the time. But it wouldn't have been that different from what it is now. But the interesting thing is, again, here in the Mary's procession, there was standed four fair virgins, clad in maced heavenly clething, and where wine flowed freely from a fountain. Toasts were drunk and glasses were smashed. The four fair ladies most probably represented the four cardinal virtues of fortitude, prudence, temperance, and justice, intended as an encouragement to live up to an idealized image of rulership.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that was fine.
Yes. Nothing too contentious.
Nothing contentious at all there.
Yeah.
That was quite good.
Okay, good.
But again, from then after they did that,
we would proceed further. How far are we? Just to give people a sense of distance, how far have we come along the procession route and how far are we along the Royal Mile?
In terms of the Royal Mile, we're not even halfway. Because the Royal Mile, like I say, was split between Canongate and Edinburgh itself. But in terms of the procession, we're probably about halfway. So we're probably a quarter of the way down the Royal Mile.
Yeah, because one of the things we were just chatting over a coffee, and one of the things that's just clicked for me is that Holyrood actually wasn't in Edinburgh. It wasn't within the city walls. It was
Correct.
A pleasure palace outside of the city walls.
Absolutely.
So the procession went through the city, and then once she'd finished, then she went on to Holyrood, but that wasn't the official procession.
No, again, remember that Holyrood was originally an abbey. It wasn't a palace. It became a palace later. It was David I that established Holyrood Abbey, and of course split. You know, it's still a mystery as to why he would have split the area here into two royal boroughs. Mm. That is very, very mysterious. It's unprecedented anywhere else.
Interesting.
So
nobody knows. Well, this is a very beautiful part of the road today, isn't it? It's very wide and open, and we're continuing downhill. Another church spire in front of us.
Yes, this is the Tron Kirk, although at the time of Mary, it was the Salt Tron, another way station. Earlier, remember, we stopped at where the Butter Tron was.
Yes.
And that was, of course, where dairy products were measured, whereas the Salt Tron was for solid goods.
Oh, I see, right, okay. But yet another formal marker in the procession.
Formal marker, and of course, very important for the commerce of the city. Because, as I say, this was a weights and measures sort of issue.
So this church here that we're coming upon now on Hunter Square, as it is today, what's the name of the church?
It's the Tron Kirk.
So that is the Tron Kirk.
Yes.
I keep forgetting, of course, we're talking church Kirk.
Yes.
It is another language.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So like I say, this was, of course, where the Salt Tron was. It wasn't a church. And here, again, the next significant thing happened in the procession. Here, speeches were made on the abolition of the Mass, which are likely to have horrified Mary. And to add insult to injury, effigies were burnt, demonstrating the destiny of those guilty of improper sacrifice.
Righty.
Here, the various accounts conflict. One saying the effigies represented Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, who were swallowed up by the ground, as related in Numbers chapter 16, verses 1 to 35, for practicing improper sacrifice. They had opposed Moses and were punished accordingly. Another account relates that an effigy of a priest in his vestments about to say Mass was thrown on the fire. But another states that this was actually prevented by the Earl of Huntly, one of Mary's staunch supporters and a Catholic. So much for Mary's policy of tolerance.
Crikey, yes.
My own deduction is that it was intended that four effigies were to be burnt, associating the rebels of Numbers with Catholic priests. But the last effigy was not actually burnt because it was prevented by Huntly.
Right.
So again, talk about an insult to Mary.
Yes, so we've come from the very pleasant, the drinking of the wine.
Yes.
The virtues of femininity, probably, to this shocking.
Yeah.
She must have been horrified.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess maybe this is when it first really hit home as to just how tricky things were going to be.
So from the Salt Tron, the procession proceeded to the Netherbow port, where Mary finally left the city. At the Netherbow port, another playlet was performed, consisting of more speeches and the burning of a dragon, which was the symbol of the Antichrist in the book of Revelations. This was probably another Protestant dig, since the Pope was seen as the Antichrist.
Goodness me, they were relentless, weren't they?
They were,
very
much.
They're trying to ram home the message. Poor woman.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
So you were saying the Netherbow port was the final gate. It was east-facing, and once you left that gate, then you'd left the city of Edinburgh.
Correct.
Correct.
The royal borough of Edinburgh, you've left. Although, of course, the procession proceeded, the people kept following her all the way down to Holyrood, because it was at Holyrood where she finally accepted properly, formally, the gift of silver plate that had presented to her way back at the castle that had followed her all the way down in the cart.
Yeah, and I bet she was quite relieved to get inside and have a stiff drink after all of that.
Yes, I think she did this before seeking solace in her own company of Holyrood House.
Oh, I thought so. Yes. Can you imagine the conversation she must have had? Goodness me.
Yes.
So that really brings us to the end, doesn't it, of Mary's progress through the city of Edinburgh.
Yes, the formal entry of the monarch into the city.
But you can actually see the brass markings, can't you, of the Netherbow port.
One of the things the city of Edinburgh has done is to have marked out various significant historical architecture that, of course, no longer physically exists but is remembered.
So you can see it just at the crossroads of Jeffrey Street and the Royal Mile, basically.
Correct.
You can see those brass markings in the road.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just wanted to thank you then for taking us on this tour today and sharing all your local knowledge with us, Mary's progress through Edinburgh. Thank you so much, Jerry.
You're absolutely welcome, and I hope people have enjoyed it, and I hope they come and enjoy the city.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that they will. Thank you.
my word, poor Mary. Goodness me, she must have felt ambushed indeed. And goodness only knows what conversations were held as she made her way back to her palace of Holyrood. Now, Holyrood, of course, as you heard in that conversation with Jerry, was well outside the city walls of Edinburgh, surrounded by Pleasant Park. And as it is today, sitting beneath the very imposing landmark of Arthur's Seat. It is, in fact, even today, a very beautiful spot. And it does feel very different to being in the heart of Edinburgh, just outside of Edinburgh Castle. And that's where we're going to go next. So we made our way along the Royal Mile and down, down, down towards Holyrood Palace, where I linked up once more with Liz Manson. Because, of course, as we heard in an earlier podcast, Holyrood was perhaps Mary's most favoured royal residence. And yet it was also the scene of one of the most horrific events to happen to Mary during her lifetime. Now, unfortunately, we weren't allowed to record whilst in the palace. So Liz and I went on our tour together and then found a rather comfortable place to sit down and muse over everything that we had just seen and talk about indeed some of the happy times and some of the tragedy that Mary experienced whilst at Holyrood. So let's go over right now and link up with Liz as we take tea in the palace's cafe courtyard. And so, yes, my friends, you will, of course, hear the sounds of life and tea drinking going on around us. So hello, everyone, and welcome once more to the next podcast in my In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots series for the month of September. And it is day 4 of my travels on the trail of Mary, and I'm back in Edinburgh, and this time at probably one of the most significant locations associated with Mary's life, and that is the Palace of Holyrood. And I'm delighted to welcome back to the show President of the Mary Stuart Society, Liz Manson. Hello again, Liz.
Hello, delighted to be here sitting in the sunshine
having a cup of tea.
Having a cup of tea.
So, folks, you may hear in the background a little bit of a hubbub. We have just been round the palace. Unfortunately, you can't record going round, so we have done our tour together, and now we are taking tea and coffee in the courtyard directly outside the palace. But it's a perfect opportunity for us to maybe digest a little bit of what we've seen and
talk about
Mary's
and
time.
And just reflect on all the things that happened in this location.
Absolutely. So, as listeners would probably know, I always like to have a little bit of context to start, and I'm interested in places. So obviously Holyrood has been long associated with Scottish royalty, but can you tell us a little bit about how it became a royal palace?
Well, it started off as a church, the Church of the Holyrood, King David I in the 1300s, so it's been very well established. Mary's grandfather did some of the building here, but it was really her father who was responsible for the part of the building that we see now and where Mary actually lived when she stayed here.
And I found out yesterday, and listeners will have heard this in a previous podcast, of course, but I'd like to reiterate it, that Holyrood was outside of the city of Edinburgh, wasn't it, in the 16th century?
That's right, yes, it was outside the city walls.
So like a pleasure palace, I guess, in some ways?
It did have some fortifications. I mean, there was a drawbridge and a moat, so it was a fairly secure place. But the attraction for the royals was there was a big park and there was hunting and beautiful gardens. So, yes, it had a combination of purposes. And this is where they would have received many guests and dignitaries.
Obviously, we've just been walking around and the end of the tour takes you through the gardens, past the ruins of the abbey that predates the palace.
Yes, indeed.
And the beautiful scenery, of course, Arthur's Seat.
That's right. I mean, it's a very splendid and very iconic part of Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So you do feel the sort of majesty and the geography lends itself to it being a special place.
Yeah, and I can imagine just how isolated and peaceful it would have been outside of the press of the city. Perfect.
as you say, for the hunting and all the pastimes that royalty would have enjoyed.
And it was built in a sort of French style, so again, it would have been beautiful by comparison for other buildings in Scotland at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So it might be just worth saying, obviously, that the palace we see today is not exactly the one that we would have seen. There is part of the palace that remains from Mary's time. Do you just want to tell us a little bit about that part of the palace, perhaps before we get into the events that happened there?
There's three floors in the palace, and the ground floor tends to be of operational rooms. They're quite plain. You go up onto the first floor, which is the state apartments, and there's a great hall. There are the rooms that Darnley would have occupied when he was here. And so they're a little more ornate, they're a little bit more fancy. And then you go onto the third floor, which is where the Queen's apartments, where Mary would have lived, and that was the royal apartment. So as you go up, they just get a little bit more grand each time.
And when you're standing outside of the building in the courtyard looking at the palace, it's the tower on the left-hand side.
The left-hand side is where the Darnley's apartments and Mary's apartments were, yes.
And it's quite special, I have to say. It's my first time going round Holyrood, and I really actually did get a sense of Mary in those apartments. They're quite small, though, aren't they? We were talking about how different it must have been to the palaces
that she had come from in France. Yes. Yeah. So although it was grand by Scottish standards, it wouldn't really have been by Mary's standards from what she had seen in France. But there would have been some elements of it that were familiar to her in the architecture. But certainly it has been remodelled a number of times, indeed for Mary's son, grandson, great-grandson. So there are elements that continued the family tradition of improving the palaces that they lived in.
Yeah, okay, good. Now, Mary came here very shortly after her return to Scotland. In fact, this was the first place she came to after landing, wasn't it?
This is where she spent her first night. And the story goes that there was a band of musicians turned up to welcome her. They weren't terribly good, and the singers and the musicians didn't necessarily all keep time with each other, but she was so polite that she did say how lovely it was and how delighted she would be if they wanted to come back every night. So I don't know if that was universally popular. But it was her home when she came back to Scotland, in 1561.
And we were hearing on the walking tour with Gerry down the Royal Mile how she left from here to go to Edinburgh Castle to make her re-entry or formal entry.
That's right, her royal progress up the Royal Mile. Yes.
But she came back here. So am I right in saying that Holyrood was one of Mary's favoured residences?
Yes, it was certainly somewhere she had some very happy occasions. She did receive ambassadors here, she did have parties here, and she got married to Darnley here, so I think that would have been a very happy occasion for her. And there are records that she did come here time and time again over the years she was in Scotland.
Now, Darnley. Now, we skipped over this subject a little bit when we were talking at Stirling Castle, but he's such a central character in Mary's story. I think now is time to talk about Henry, Lord Darnley. So, yeah, maybe you could tell us about how that all came about. I think we talked a little bit about it, about Stirling, but what happened after Mary fell in love with Darnley and what transpired here at Holyrood?
Well, she certainly did fall in love with him. I think that was a very genuine emotion at the time. They got married here, and pretty soon after they were married, she did discover that he was a thoroughly bad lot, that he was going out with his friends in the taverns of Edinburgh. He was having all sorts of liaisons, and he was drunk quite often, he was thoroughly unpleasant, he was petulant if he didn't get his own way. So there would have been time here when Mary realised, I think, that she had made a terrible mistake.
Yeah, and that happened not too long after they were married, I think.
Yes, by the Christmas time they were estranged. So they married in the July and they were estranged by Christmas.
Yikes.
But she would have got pregnant round about the October. So you know, there were clearly times when the two of them were getting on, but it was a difficult relationship, and really by the Christmas time it had turned sour for them.
Now I just want to take a sidestep for a moment, because you were telling me maybe, or it's been proven that Darnley probably suffered from syphilis?
did suffer from syphilis?
That's right. I think the medical examination of his skull has proven that he did have syphilis. And the irony was that if he hadn't been murdered, he probably would have died not that long after that time period anyway. So a difficult one to think about, because if they had just waited, who knows, history would have been very different. But because of his behaviour, as I say, going round taverns and his relationships and liaisons, he had contracted syphilis at quite an early age.
And he was universally hated, wasn't he? I think we touched on that at Stirling. He obviously had some friends, but by and large, people did not like him.
No, he was a very difficult person to like, I think.
Sounds like
but he
it.
Had been brought up as a very spoiled child, and I think that would have been a difficult situation for him to get over. And he was still a very young man. He was only 19 when he got married. And so to be thrust into that life and to be used by the Protestant lords, who were a very fickle and manipulative bunch, I think he had quite a difficult time of it himself.
Yes, I can imagine. And so I think you're starting to allude to perhaps one of the most dramatic incidents that happened here. So can you talk about the events that led up to the murder of Mary's secretary?
Yes, so David Rizzio was part of Mary's entourage. He actually was a minstrel, but she formed a relationship with him as friends because he was very entertaining. He was an excellent musician. Mary loved music. He was a good dancer. Mary loved dancing. And he fitted in well with Mary and her friends at the palace, indeed here at Holyrood House. He quickly became her clerk and her correspondent with France. And so because she had a great affinity to France and the people she'd left behind, they formed a close relationship, just because they were writing and they were corresponding to people. So I think it was a genuine friendship as well as a business relationship, but that caused a lot of jealousy and distrust amongst the Protestant lords and indeed Darnley himself. There was a suggestion that Darnley and Rizzio had a relationship at one point, so there was maybe even a bit of jealousy in Darnley's part as well of Mary's closeness with David Rizzio. And so the lords decided that Rizzio had to go.
And so what happened? Because they drew Darnley into this plot, even though they didn't really care for him, they used him essentially,
That's
didn't
right.
they?
They absolutely used him. They preyed upon his suspicions and his insecurities. And Darnley allowed them to use his apartments to get access to Mary's private apartments, where the threatened Darnley in front of Mary. Mary was unable to protect Rizzio, and they dragged him into the next room and they stabbed him about 57 times.
Because when you go around the palace, as you say, that you get into that tower and you're in Darnley's apartments first, and then you go up a flight of
a small winding staircase.
So that's how they accessed Mary's.
That's right, Mary's private chambers.
I felt quite an energy in that staircase.
Yes,
actually.
And it all feels very stealth-like and malevolent.
Yes,
I think,
it
doesn't
does.
It?
And so Darnley burst in, didn't he, at the head of the?
Yes, they burst in, and a number of them dragged Rizzio, as I say, into the next room where they stabbed him. Mary was threatened with a gun held against her belly. She was 6 months pregnant at the time. And so to be able to survive that dreadful incident...
And was it Darnley
at the
who
best
was holding
of times.
That?
No, that was one of the other Protestant lords who was doing that.
Right, okay.
But they made sure that Darnley was involved in the stabbing so that he was part
well
of
implicated
that.
In it. And then this incredible thing happens, which I still haven't quite got my head around, so maybe you can explain it to me. Maybe not. But Mary then escapes, but with Darnley. She's managed to turn him around somehow.
Yes, I can't explain that. It just demonstrates Mary's persuasive skills and her quick thinking, because, again, just having witnessed a murder, a very violent murder of someone so close to her, there was clearly a threat for her. So to have the presence of mind to work out how you get out of Holyrood Palace, where she was guarded, and persuade Darnley to go with her. She really was an incredible person to have to work out how to do that.
Do we have any idea what the Confederate Lords had in mind, you know, immediately after that event? Because as you say, she was kind of imprisoned in Holyrood. Do we have any idea what they were planning to do from that point?
I think power was clearly an element, and had Mary suffered a miscarriage, had she collapsed perhaps herself, they had Darnley in their thrall, and he could be King of Scotland legally.
Yeah.
And so they would have controlled Scotland through him.
Through him, right, okay. But escape she did. So where did they go to?
They rode to Dunbar Castle. And again, 6 months pregnant, she rode all these miles to Dunbar Castle.
How
and
far
she
is
must
it
have been in
here?
Shock. It's in East Lothian, so it's possibly about 20 miles away.
Okay. Wow.
Something like that. You know, at night. I mean, that's, and again, just not just strength of character, but personal strength and fortitude to be able to get on a horse and ride to freedom, then that is an amazing thing to have done.
Okay, so maybe we need to fast forward a little bit to Darnley's end and what happened then, because it was such a pivotal. It happened here, obviously, in Edinburgh.
That's right.
Mary was here at the time.
Well, echoing actually the Stirling Castle experience, when Darnley was ill, Mary was looking after him. He was located at Kirkle Field, which is just about half a mile away from Holyrood Palace. And she was visiting him to try and take care of him, to help care for him while he was ill. So she had one of her pages, Bastian Page, had a wedding feast that Mary was going to go to. And so she left Darnley for that period of time. And as some of your listeners may already know, what happened then was that there had been gunpowder located in the cellar of the place Darnley was staying, which was blown up, but his body was actually found in the garden in his nightdress, strangled. So clearly the blast didn't kill him, and somebody had finished him off in the garden along with one of his servants. And the big question is, of course, did Mary know? Was Mary part of the plot? Was she involved in that? Was it a happy circumstance that she had disappeared off to a wedding when it actually happened?
Because by this time she did loathe him, didn't she?
And she did loathe him, and they had had discussions about what to do about the Darnley problem. Mary was adamant that there would be no divorce because that would make her son illegitimate. And I think she did recognise that there was a problem with any solution. Darnley had been talking about going to France. So there were various possibilities floating around at the time that that Mary was involved in some of these discussions.
So I have to ask you, what do you think happened? Was Mary involved? Did she know the murder of her husband?
I don't think she knew. I think she had a very strong faith, and I don't think she would have condoned the murder of anyone like that, never mind the father of her child and her husband.
Because in so many other ways, I mean, kind of the evidence that weighs in that favour, I guess, is that She was a very lenient monarch, wasn't she, generally?
Yeah, partly that was her problem, in a way that Elizabeth I would deal with any potential treason or anyone who committed an offence against her person or her throne. Mary pardoned people. She was too kind in many cases.
Yeah.
And I think, therefore, the people who wished to cause her harm and who were troublemakers were still around.
Yes.
In her court and in her land, in a way that they weren't in England.
Because, as you said, as we were walking around and talking about this very incident, she even pardoned the people who murdered her secretary, David Rizzio, didn't
That's
she?
That's right, who she had seen with her own eyes being part of that. And some of that is about statecraft, but the Scottish lords were so fickle, they changed from side to side, depending on their own power base, depending on their own family relationships, that she really didn't have anyone she could rely on 100%.
Yes, in power. I mean, I guess she only had her female attendants, the four Marys, for example, that she could trust.
That's
right.
Do you
think there was any man she could completely put her trust in court at the time?
Well, I think she probably thought the Earl of Bothwell was one of those, because she had known him her whole life. He had been loyal to her mother. He had been there in France when she was a child. So she actually had known him all her life, and I think she misguidedly thought that he was loyal and she could trust him. But again, at the end, he proved he was only out for his own power base and his own profile.
Oh, Bothwell is just one of those characters. When he deserts her at Borthwick, so he doesn't desert her just once, he does it again at Carberry Hill. I mean, once is almost forgivable, but twice, never.
And I suppose she thought that she was saving him, probably.
Maybe.
But yes, again, how misguided. And I think a lot of her misjudgment comes from the fact that when she grew up in France, she was never trained in these arts of statecraft. She didn't have the intrigue and the difficult times that, say, Elizabeth I had from a very early
That's
age.
True, yes.
So for Mary's childhood, she had a very blessed and happy period that she trusted people. She was happy. She had a very stable life, and therefore she was completely ill-equipped for the turmoil that was Scotland in that period.
That's a really good point, isn't it? Because when you do think about it, of course, Elizabeth had to navigate such difficult, turbulent waters right through from being, you know, an infant, really. So she had been steeped in that.
Yes, and I think, and Elizabeth's advisors were absolutely committed to England and the safety of the realm in a way that Mary did not have people who were really truly interested in Scotland.
They were all interested in
their own families, their own money, their own lands.
Both of those points I think are really important to understand the context of Mary's story and just why things went so disastrously wrong, or certainly part of the reason. Now, you mentioned Bothwell. So maybe we could talk a little bit about how Bothwell, I mean, as you said, Mary knew Bothwell for a long, long period of time, but then she married him. What happened there?
I do not know. I think that, yes, there was an emerging relationship, and Bothwell was certainly getting the lords to sign the bond to say that they thought Mary should marry him. And then there was the famous scene where she was captured and taken back to his castle. Whether or not she was coerced or raped, I think there are different views about that. Kate Williams certainly states that she was raped. But we do know that he ceased not, in Mary's words, in a letter at a later stage.
Uh-huh.
So there certainly clearly was some coercion at that incident. And I think Mary then knew or thought she was pregnant, and therefore that to me explains why she agreed to marry him so quickly, because the prospect
of
being...
How long after she was abducted by him did she marry him?
It was just a matter of weeks,
right.
A couple of months.
So
she
could well have known then
so
she
I
was
think
pregnant.
She, or she suspected that she might be, and the prospect of being unmarried and pregnant as a queen would have been unimaginable for Mary and for Scotland. And I think that's why she agreed so quickly to marry him.
And she married him here at Holyrood?
She did, in a Protestant ceremony which caused her great distress.
Wow. What do we know about that then? Is there an account of either from her letter or from a
eyewitness? There is a basic account about who conducted the marriage ceremony, but Mary was clearly quite unhappy about it, and she did write afterwards that she had regretted having a Protestant ceremony.
Oh my goodness. I wonder if that caused her to question that marriage in her conscience, in any way at all.
I don't know whether she had time, to be honest, to question it, because so soon afterwards that they were on the run, that there was again the negotiations with the Scottish lords, and then they met at Carberry and Boswell disappeared. And then she was taken to Loch Leven, where she miscarried and was forced to abdicate the next day.
That all happened from marriage to Loch Leven in a matter of weeks,
yes.
Didn't it?
Yes.
Wow.
You know, it was June that she miscarried and had to abdicate. So, you know, and again, just having the state of mind to be in after all of that happening to you. You know, and you just think what happened to her between she was 18 and 6 years in Scotland. She packed more into these few years than most people do in a lifetime.
Indeed. But let's talk about just a little bit about visiting Holyrood, really. Mm-hmm. So any top tips for people who are visiting this part of Edinburgh and Holyrood in particular? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm bound to say, obviously, the Mary Queen of Scots
of
apartments.
Course.
You know, the people here today, as we walked around, people were generally quite dispersed. But when we got to Mary's apartments,
yes.
You know, that's where the queue was and that's where people stayed. And so that that opportunity to be in a place where history happened is something I think that's very special. But the gardens are beautiful and you do get a sense of royalty and regal status. The Queen stays here 1 week every year. And there's been many, many people, many things have happened here. So it's a wonderful place just to be where people have trod before you. And you're right opposite the Scottish Parliament. And as you walk up to Edinburgh Castle, you can obviously scowl at John Knox's house and visit St Giles, where Mary visited. So again, it's just all of these places, as you would have heard from the Royal Progress and Mary's entrance into Edinburgh, amazing things have happened in the short distance between Holyrood Palace here and Edinburgh Castle up at the top.
And speaking of Edinburgh Castle, that is where I am going to be going tomorrow, because of course Mary left here, didn't she, after the murder of her secretary, and that is where she gave birth to
That's
her
right,
son
yes.
and heir. So another important stop. So we'll be going there shortly, folks, in the next podcast, so make sure that you stay tuned for that. Before we bring our chats today to a close, I think we should talk about the Mary Stuart Society. First of all, I'd like to thank you so much for helping me organise so many of my trips here to Scotland and getting people to meet with me and share their expertise. Thank you. Now, there may be people, though, who are listening who've never heard of the Mary Stuart Society or indeed would like to know more. So who are you and what do you do?
So we are formed in 1992 to mark the 450th anniversary of Mary's birth, and we've got members from around the world, much as your listeners and viewers are from different countries around the world. We have members in Australia, America, Brazil, and many places in Europe, but mostly certainly in the UK. And we have events and visits to places of Marian interest. We're interested not just in Mary herself, but in her life and times, because there's so much in that period of history, the Scottish Reformation, advances in universities and education and learning, in the infrastructure, in food. So there's so much to think about and to be interested in that we like to cover the whole range. And I think we would always make the point, we're not a fan club. although, obviously, we admire some of Mary's qualities, as we've talked about, her fortitude, her compassion, her interest in people. But also, we are interested in how the decisions that she made and what went wrong and what ifs is another part of our discussions. We have a journal that we publish which contains sort of academic information as well as members' views and their visits to places. We've got a project just now where we're trying to record all the places where people see anything at all of Mary, because her image crops up in many weird and wonderful places. And we're also supporting, we put plaques up in key places where Mary was. We have the statue at Linlithgow that I think you've already visited.
I have, yes.
And we're also supporting the Glasgow University project about the memorialisation of Mary. So we have a number of different activities that we do, and we're called the Mary Stuart Society because that's what Mary called herself. She wrote Mary Stuart, that was how she signed her name. She's better known here, of course, as Mary Queen of Scots, but we do want to honour what she called herself, and that's why we're the Mary Stuart Society. But to make it accessible, our website is maryqueenofscots.co.uk.
Excellent.
Very reasonable membership rates, of course, and we do write to members as well as the journal, just with snippets about Mary and the news and things of interest.
That's wonderful. So if people want to join, what should they do?
Just go onto the website and you'll get all the details there.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Not at all. Delighted to be part of this event.
Well, all that remains for me to say is thank you so much for joining us both at Stirling and here today at Holyrood. It has been lovely to walk around with you and see Mary's apartments and to talk to you about her life. Thank you, Liz.
Great. Not at all. You're very welcome. It's been most enjoyable.
So do consider supporting the work of the Mary Stuart Society. They're a very active group, and if you love Mary Stuart, it's the place to be, folks. Well, with that, I just want to thank both Jerry and Liz for giving of their time and their passion and their love for Mary to meet with me in Edinburgh and take us on our tour of the Royal Mile and of Holyrood, and to share the reflections of some, as I say, some of the most dramatic events in Mary's life. Okay, well, that's the end of our episode today. We just have one more left. And next week, in fact, I'll be returning to Edinburgh, this time to tour the castle. Of course, the castle is most famous as the place in which Mary fled to following the murder of David Rizzio, and where she gave birth to her son and heir. And we will be getting a very exclusive peek into Mary's bedchamber, so don't miss out. And in fact, even more of a reason to tune in is that we will be having an audience with Her Majesty herself. Yes, my friends, Mary, Queen of Scots, granted me an audience where I could put some of the most challenging questions to her, and you will hear how I was firmly put in my place. Don't miss out, folks. That's coming next week. Keep a lookout. It will be dropped next Saturday and will conclude our In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots season. So with that, I look forward to seeing you next week, and all that remains for me to say, my friends, is a happy time travelling. Thank you.